Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 077162. In re Step Series 7 Broker Qualification and Family. Foreign litigation. William Lowe et al. Appellants versus the National Association of Security Dealers, Inc. et al. Mr. Martin, the appellant. Mr. Cox, appellee, FINRA, Inc. Mr. Carbon, appellee, Ed Sport.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Jerry Martin from Nashville, Tennessee, along with my colleague Herb Milstein of the D.C. Bar. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case comes before the court as a result of approximately 1,900 individuals being informed erroneously that they failed the Series 7 examination, which is an examination administered by the NASD. The Series 7 examination is really the most basic examination for the most basic licensing requirement that entitles individuals to sell and buy securities. In January of 2006, the NASD informed these approximately 1,900 individuals that they had in fact passed the exam, even though they had been informed over the previous 18 months that they had failed the exam. Subsequently, in press releases and statements to the media, the NASD indicated that the error was a result of a coding mistake that was inadvertently made by an EDS technician. The plaintiffs filed their lawsuit alleging common law negligence claims against both the NASD and the EDS. At the initial case management conference, the district court stayed discovery, including initial disclosures, after the NASD and EDS informed the court that they intended to file a 12B6 motion, with the thrust of that motion largely being that they were entitled to absolute immunity. Now, they certainly alleged other defenses, but the thrust of their argument was that they should be absolutely immune from the plaintiff's claims, based on a series of cases predominantly arising out of the Second Circuit. Ultimately, the district court decided that NASD and EDS were not entitled to absolute immunity, and instead reasoned that the case law relied upon by EDS and NASD sounded in preemption. We agree that NASD and EDS are not entitled to absolute immunity, but we disagree with the district court's determination that...
Isn't that an unfair statement? The district court didn't conclude there was no absolute immunity.
I disagree, Your Honor. Let me read two sentences.
Well, I thought he tended in that direction, but he didn't decide.
Let me read this sentence from the court's opinion. The court agrees that defendants do not satisfy the absolute immunity test. And then skipping a sentence, the creation and administration of a standardized competency exam for admission to the securities industry bears little resemblance to the kinds of quasi-judicial function that typically support absolute immunity.
Well, what difference does it make? We still can reach that question.
That's right.
So the question that I have is, why isn't regulatory immunity applicable in this case? If you look at the Second, Ninth, and Eleventh Circuit, they're acting instead of the agency and performing responsibilities within their regulatory compass. Why isn't this a straightforward case of regulatory immunity?
I believe that all of those cases can be distinguished from the case at hand because all of those cases involve an element of discretion or some kind of deliberative process. The first three cases, sort of in the lineage of those cases, would be Austin, Barbara, and D'Alessio. And in those cases, the court, which would be the Fifth Circuit and the Second Circuit, applied a traditional judicial immunity to cases involving disciplinary actions or arbitrations or prosecutorial immunity. The very first of those cases is Austin, and Austin relied heavily on the Supreme Court's test in Butts, that the underlying conduct or action should function and has the characteristics of a judicial process, that recriminatory lawsuits are likely, and that there are adequate safeguards. So those first...
Let me get you at least on my track to hear your answer. That is not the thrust of the cases that I'm looking at. They're talking much more broadly in terms of regulatory, adjudicatory, or prosecutorial responsibilities. This is certainly within the regulatory compass. We decide what test is to be administered and whether or not you've passed it, which effectively determines whether or not you're licensed. That is, instead of the agency, they're doing it in the agency's stead. I don't see how this doesn't fit. This is not like the marketing case where they're promoting private activities where one of the courts said that's too far. But, I mean, if you look at the Second Circuit case, they even go more broadly than that. I don't know how this easily fits the Second Circuit case law, but if you look at the more refined cases in the Ninth and the 11th Circuit, this is within regulatory compasses instead of what the agency does. This is one of the most important regulatory functions the agency has.
Well, I would distinguish between what the defendants call as the integrity of the gatekeeping system versus an administrative act by a privately held company or a publicly held company performing under an IT contract. I think the cases that you're relying on can all still be distinguished from the facts at hand, the Sparta Surgical, the DL Capital, and the Dexter cases. At the core of all of those cases is a decision that's being made by the SRO, the decision in Sparta Surgical to suspend trading.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question. Suppose the judiciary in a particular state, as is often true, is responsible for admitting members to the bar. And they do usually a little investigation beforehand. Let's put aside the question of the bar exam itself. And suppose X is applying for admission to the bar, and the judiciary in the state takes a quick look at his or her background and negligently makes a mistake and mixes up that individual with somebody else and says, okay, you cannot be a member of our bar because of a misdeed back when you were 21 years old or 19 years old. And they got the wrong person. And in fact, that is publicized and this individual is injured badly. Is there immunity?
Possibly because of
Wait. Possibly?
Well,
you're supposed to give us answers. We're supposed to be possible.
Right, I understand. I would say that in that factual scenario, it sounds to me like a decision in some kind of adjudicatory process is being challenged. And if that's the case,
adjudicatory process is simply a gatekeeping process allowing members of the bar individuals to become members of the bar. It's got nothing to do with discipline. It's got nothing to do with the normal judicial functions. Why isn't that exactly the same as what we have here?
Because there's no discretion in what's happening here.
It's the same kind of discretion. Let's say, in my case, the mistake was made by a subcontractor who was working for the court got the names mixed up.
Then I would argue that there's no immunity under those facts.
All right, but if it was, in fact, a clerk of the court that made the mistake, there would be immunity?
Probably in the context of judicial immunity, yes.
But if the court subcontracted to somebody else to do it rather than hiring a clerk, there wouldn't be immunity.
I would argue yes.
What theory supports that proposition?
Well,
isn't that very much like our case?
Well, one argument that I would make against that, Your Honor, is...
Which? That it's very much like our case?
That is very much that your scenario is very much like our case. I think the scenario where it's been outsourced and there's an administrative mistake is like our case.
Could you sue the judiciary?
Probably not under judicial immunity. But
why not? It's negligence. Isn't that the same theory under which you're suing The SEC?
Well, the immunity that would apply here, if at all, would be what's commonly referred to as regulatory immunity.
Yes.
And so the test is what the defendants argue is that
in my hypothetical, the judiciary is performing a regulatory function, not a judicial function.
Right. Well, to the extent that there's an extension of regulatory immunity in that scenario, and there's some standing in the shoes of some regulatory agency, then I think the answer is no if it's an administrative task.
Where are you finding that in the line of cases? Because the cases that I was pointing to you talk in terms of immune from liability for claims arising out of the discharge of its duties under the Act. It doesn't distinguish between the discharge of its, as you suggest, the discretionary duties as distinguished from administrative duties as distinguished from whatever else. Where are you finding this line of authority?
Well,
it distinguishes between those activities that are within the compass of regulatory responsibilities as distinguished, say, private activities, marketing, and the like. But I don't see the line you're talking about.
I would argue, Your Honor, that all of those cases at their core involved a discretionary function.
If that's what was really going on, I can't imagine three circuits that I'm looking at right in front of me now. No one mentions it.
Well, they all describe the activity and
right. And they cap it by saying is immune from liability for claims arising out of the discharge of their duties.
Right. And the
certain types of duties.
The underlying activity is always decision making in those cases. And one argument that I think that the district court found compelling and led to the result of at least not deciding immunity, which we think that he decided there was no absolute immunity, is the argument that if you're standing in the shoes of the SEC, then the SEC then must get the immunity for the exact same action. However, under the Federal Tort Claims Act, it appears that that's not true, that the sovereign, the federal government, is immune unless it's explicitly waived. The Federal Tort Claims Act, however, allows you to bring a claim for an error or omission by the SEC. Under the Berkowitz decision, the only argument that the SEC would probably be entitled to make would be that it was a discretionary function. And a discretionary function analysis under the Federal Tort Claims Act is conduct cannot be discretionary unless it involves an element of judgment or choice.
Why isn't that true here? Why isn't your lawsuit against the SEC based on the proposition that they negligently picked a subcontractor?
Because they're entitled.
Doesn't negligence, by definition, go to question of judgment?
Doesn't negligence, by definition, go to judgment? I don't believe so. Not always. I mean, I think.
Doesn't in this case.
It doesn't in this case. It does not in this case because.
How can you say that the SEC is liable unless you conclude that it was negligent in picking EDS?
Well, my hypothetical is that if the SEC had not delegated this function to the NASD, who then in turn delegated it to the SEC, my analysis is if the SEC had decided to do this action itself.
Your theory, you're suing the NASD.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're suing EDS.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, aren't you concluding that the NASD negligently chose EDS?
Well, that's part of our theory. The other part of our...
What about that part of the theory? Isn't that part of the theory necessarily rest on judgment, discretion?
That element of the case is more difficult, would be more difficult if that was our only claim against the only way to describe the conduct against NASD. I would agree with that.
Your claim has got to be based on breach of contract, I guess.
Well,
a third-party beneficiary.
Right, but to go...
That's pretty thin, isn't it?
The best claim is the negligence claim, Your Honor.
Well, then that clearly runs right afoul of negligence. I have discretion, doesn't it?
Well,
even under your theory.
But here's what we don't know, Your Honor, about what happened. The NASD... we haven't had any discovery. The NASD hasn't denied any co-participation in the error that an EDS technician allegedly caused. We don't really know what the NASD did, but to the extent, if you remand this case and we go back and we get discovery, and to the extent, I would agree, to the extent that our claim could only be limited to negligent supervision, then that would be very difficult. That would be a difficult claim to proceed against the NASD, but we don't...
Your only other theory is the third-party beneficiary contract claim.
That's right, Your Honor.
That's pretty thin, isn't it?
Well, the negligence claim is the better claim, I would agree.
Better claim for purposes of tort law, but worse for purposes of immunity.
That's probably correct.
What between the devil and the deep blue sea?
Right. Well, again, it all goes back to the conduct in question, and it's our position that the conduct in question was very remote from the regulatory scheme, very remote. Rule 1070 of the NASD rules only authorizes test. It does not indicate that, or it doesn't state how tests should be administered. It doesn't have any safeguards.
This was all discretionary.
No, what was not
Sure it was discretionary. You just said this was within their regulatory compass. You just described the thing you wanted to run from. This involved great discretion as to whether to have a test, if so, what kind of test, how to administer it, and then how to measure it.
Right, and we're not challenging any of those things. We're challenging an error.
In that process, yeah, they made a mistake in doing that. In the exercise of their discretion, they fouled up.
Well, the foul up is very remote from the exercise of discretion in this case, because it's literally just transposing coding variables. And if that's not an administrative function, the hypothetical I think that the EDS gets some benefit from this being an IT service or IT contract, because it seems sort of nebulous and arcane if it's information technology. But I think a better hypothetical would be, or an appropriate hypothetical would be, what if the NASD hired a temporary service to mail out the letters? This is before the test. And if that temp service put the wrong letters in the wrong envelopes, would that be a discretionary function, or would that be very far removed from the regulatory functions of the NASD? And I think it would be. Is exactly.
You're mixing up discretionary and regulatory. It's certainly within the regulatory compass.
Right. It's within the regulatory function. But is it a discretionary act, or is it an administrative
act? Who says
that's
required?
Well, I think.
You're riding that horse, and I don't know where it's coming from. I can't find the horse.
Right. Well,
the argument is based on Westfall.
Right. It's based on Westfall and Butts v. County.
Right.
It's based on Westfall, Your Honor. It's based on Westfall, which.
You found the horse, huh?
Right. Exactly. Thank you, Your Honor. It's based on Westfall. I've exceeded my time. I still would like to reserve the 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Douglas Cox, and I'm representing FINRA, known in this case as the NASD. With me today is Jennifer Shulp. Let me begin by following up on some of Judge Edwards' questions. It is indeed the case that the NASD's regulatory immunity is very broad, and that the Second Circuit and the Ninth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit have all said that SROs, self-regulatory organizations like the NASD, are immune from liability based on the discharge of their duties under the Exchange Act.
Isn't it fair to say, Mr. Cox, that the Supreme Court seems to be less hospitable to this theory than the Second and the Ninth Circuit?
Well, Your Honor, this theory in this form hasn't gone up, so it's hard to say they're less hospitable.
Well, that's true, this particular issue, but they've been more grudging in recognizing a broad absolute immunity doctrine.
Well, Your Honor, I think for one point I would make would be when you look at the Billing decision, CSFB case versus Billing in the Supreme Court, there you have a conflict between the Exchange Act on the one hand and the antitrust laws on the other. There is a clear-cut authority under the antitrust laws to bring suit, and the Supreme Court held that the antitrust laws must be displaced within the zone of SEC regulation. Now, I understand that that's not exactly this, but it does reflect the Supreme Court's receptivity to the notion that there is, in effect, a zone of immunity having to do with the Exchange Act.
Isn't it?
It's preemption, you're right, Your Honor.
All right, let me put to you a straight question. Which do you think is the stronger argument for you, the regulatory immunity or the negative implied right of action and thereby preemption? Which of the two arguments do you think is stronger?
Your Honor, I think they're both very strong. I think there's more jurisdiction.
I knew you were going to.
Yes, I know you knew that. I think that there is more decisional law under the absolute immunity doctrine, but I also believe that Judge Bates was correct when he went through and very carefully analyzed those decisions and said, you know, there is running through the absolute immunity decisions a stream of analysis that reflects the fact that when you have this congressional scheme under the Exchange Act, no express right of action, a clear intent that the SEC regulate and control and have a national uniform standard, Congress gives a limited remedy involving review at the SEC and then review in the appellate court, but not the damages remedy plaintiff wants, that in that setting, it is appropriate to say that state law, common law torts are displaced.
If assuming under the regulatory immunity doctrine that, or the general immunity, absolute immunity doctrine, you have to distinguish between discretionary and non-discretionary acts, do you think counsel's position with respect to negligence, either on the part of the NASD or EDS, runs afoul of discretion?
I think, Your Honor, that the acts here were clearly discretionary. Now,
well, wait a minute. On his tort theory, negligence, it seems to me you're quite strong because that has to be a question of judgment and therefore discretion. What about his contract theory?
Your Honor, I believe that against...
That's where he's claiming absolute liability.
Your Honor, I believe that against the NASD, they have dropped their contract claim. They're proceeding against the NASD on the two immunity, on
right,
the two negligence theories.
Have it under EDS. Oh, you're not arguing.
I'm not arguing for EDS, yes, Mr. Carver.
You're flushing EDS.
No, not at all, Your Honor. But I think the point remains, Your Honor, that when you're talking about regulatory immunity, there are lots of decisions in that area. And as Judge Edwards says, none of them talks about the discretionary ministerial line. So if this court were to introduce that into the regulatory immunity analysis, that would be an innovation in the law.
All right. Now, so the district court struggled with the problem that the opposing counsel raised, that the immunity comes because you're acting instead of the regulatory agency, the agency. And the agency could be sued under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And if we pursued the analysis there, and this was an action against the SEC, is it so clear that the SEC gains immunity in this context?
Yes, Your Honor, for a number of reasons. Several of them are simply technical pleading reasons, you know, that the SEC has itself not waived under the FTCA. There was no demand against the agency, which the FTCA requires. Assuming you got over those technicalities.
Well, I'm just taking the hypothetical. Assume we're there.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. It's clear when you look at what is actually alleged in the complaint that the allegation is that the NASD made errors in crafting the exam, in supervising their contractor, in designing the exam and allocating resources to update the exam. And those types of allegations going to the allocation of resources and supervising of contractors are precisely the functions that this court and other courts have recognized are at the heart of the discretionary analysis. But, Your Honor, I want to go back to where I was a moment ago with Judge Silberman. As I said, the regulatory immunity cases don't talk about this discretionary ministerial line, and that if this court were to adopt that, that would be an innovation in the law. And I think as we see in this case, there are peculiar reasons why SROs should have regulatory immunity that once it is determined that they're acting consistent with the Exchange Act, they're deemed to be immune without further analysis. And there are a number of those reasons. One reason, Your Honor, is that when you take people under the Westfall case, private actors performing government contracts, they only get sued if something goes wrong, if the design for the helicopter is erroneous. The SROs, like the NASD, we're in the market every day. We make thousands of decisions, and all of those decisions create winners and losers. So there's an enormous incentive for people to sue. That's indeed one of the reasons why there's all this case law, Your Honor, that you mentioned. So that if you had a rule that said, we're going to let people sue SROs for ministerial acts, you're opening the courthouse doors in a way that they haven't been opened. And, Your Honor, we see what happened.
You wouldn't have any doubt, would you, that if the NASD had hired a trucking company to deliver the test results to a particular spot and the trucking company ran over someone, that the NASD would not have immunity?
That's right, Your Honor, but you look at the function being performed there.
Well, the function was the delivering of the test results. Isn't that part and parcel of the regulatory ambit, as you would put it?
But no, Your Honor, I think there the lawsuit you're hypothesizing would be a lawsuit based upon the fact someone was driving a truck and hit someone.
Yes, but then the claim would be NISD negligently chose this particular trucking company.
And as I say, I think with respect to the accident, as opposed to what happens with the tests, with respect to the accident.
Someone who took the test.
There you go. There you go. But we would not be immune there. But, Your Honor, I think this case also...
What was that? You said if you hit someone who took the test, you would not be immune.
For the hitting of the person with the truck. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, for the negligence in picking the trucking company.
There could be a lawsuit that says you picked the wrong trucking company.
Well, why is that distinguished from this case?
For at least two reasons, Your Honor. The first reason is, as I mentioned a moment ago, you look at the function being performed. Here, this function is the regulatory function of acting as the gatekeeper. And I think that in the truck hypothesis, that the suit you described isn't about that regulatory function. And secondly, when you look at what's...
Okay, let's take a next hypothetical. Suppose you hire somebody to communicate the regulatory results, and they make a mistake.
That, Your Honor, actually is very close to the facts in the DL Capital case in the Second Circuit, where the plaintiffs, like the plaintiffs here, were confronted with a wall of immunity cases, tried to plead around it by saying, we're not suing about the regulatory function, we're suing about its communication, and the Second Circuit was very clear, we're not going to let you chop up the immune function.
Why would the communication be different if it's the communication by truck?
Well, Your Honor, as I say, you could vary your truck hypothesis so that what is being sued about is not running over the person. If what you said was, gee, because the truck ran over the person, the exam results were delayed in being communicated, then I think you'd be back on the immunity side.
I see.
But, Your Honor, I think that this whole discussion shows why you don't want to get into the ministerial discretionary line for regulatory immunity.
Okay, let me go back to the implied right of action and preemption. It seems to me you have a very strong argument there's no implied right of action. Why does that extend to preemption? Isn't that a bit unusual? What other support do you have for that proposition?
Well, Your Honor, the fact of the matter is that when you look at cases like Sparta, an absolute immunity case out of the Ninth Circuit, they also went on to say, you know, we can't have state law claims coming in and deciding how it is that SROs are to perform their function.
Why can't we? Is that a policy judgment by judges? Or is that, where do you get that out of a congressional act?
Your Honor, you get it out of the Exchange Act, the way the Exchange Act is structured, particularly in this area, which contemplates that the SROs will be the frontline regulators, close oversight by the SEC, rights of appeal through the SROs to the SEC, and then to the courts of appeal.
Like an overwhelming case, there's no implied right of action. But there's no claim here that there's an implied right of federal action. The more difficult question is to say, because there is no implied right of action, we deduce that Congress intended to preempt any state right of action. And where do you have any cases that support that? Of course, if Congress, by its legislative history or its legislation, intends to preclude state causes of action, then you have such a situation. But we don't have that here. And where do you have a case which would make that jump?
Your Honor, you know, the structure of the Exchange Act is relevant. The fact that there's no express right of action and no implied right of action are indicia that they want there to be a uniform federal rule which would displace state law. In addition, Your Honor, in the Barbara case and in Sparta, which I've already mentioned, in Fines and Desiderio, those are all cases where the courts basically say you can't have state law claims grounded in recognized state law causes of action against SROs when what you are suing about is the performance of their regulatory duties. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. May it please the court, Michael Carvin for EDS. I'd like to begin by responding to Judge Silverman's last question. Obviously, there's normally a difference between preemption, where you don't want to displace traditional state regulation. So if we were talking about a state regulating a broker and there was a federal broker, you wouldn't naturally imply it. But here we've got a very different situation where the defendant is exercising a federal regulatory function. So, for example, in the Buckman case, the Supreme Court said that the relationship between a federal regulator and those regulated is uniquely federal interest, where there's no presumption against preemption. Very similar analysis in the Boyle case, 487 U.S. 500, where they were talking about federal contractors. And obviously this reflects, I would say, the ancient principle since McCulloch versus Maryland, that it's not a traditional state ability to regulate somebody acting on behalf of the government. Maryland couldn't tax or impose financial liabilities on a federally created bank because that would inherently frustrate the bank's ability to perform its job. So I would suggest that the private right of action and preemption analysis are essentially the same in this context, because if you're going to expose federal regulators to damages actions, it would be like adding a damages claim to the APA. You are automatically frustrating them in their ability to get at the kinds of regulation that will protect the investing public, and you don't want to frustrate the scheme in that way.
In other words, as I understand your argument, this is a stronger case for the preclusion of a federal implied right of action than the Court v. Ashe line of cases. This is not a case where Congress didn't specifically authorize it. This is rather, in your view, a case where Congress implicitly precluded it.
Absolutely. Very much like the analysis in the Credit Suisse case by the Supreme Court, where there's implicit preclusion of antitrust cases. Or, for example, where this court has looked at, is there a private right of action under Bivens? If Congress has created a reticulated comprehensive scheme, you will not imply subject federal employees to even constitutional tort analysis, because Congress has already said this is the way we want to enforce the duties of federal employees. In this case, we want the SEC to ensure uniformity on behavior of the SRO and its designees. So we don't want 50 state courts coming in and imposing a damages action which will displace the SEC's fundamental role, just as the FDA would have been displaced in the Buckman analysis. And even in Buckman, of course, the defendant in that case was not somebody exercising a regulatory function. It was simply an applicant who had allegedly defrauded the FDA, which I also think belies their argument that, oh, there's no big deal here because the SRO wouldn't want this mistake to have happened, and so there's no harm in having 50 state courts bring damages actions. Obviously, in the FDA case, they wouldn't want to be defrauded. But the court noted that if you inject this private damages action, you create all kinds of perverse incentives for the regulator, plus which you displace the regulator from coming up with a uniform, consistent scheme where, for example, as Judge Edwards was pointing out, you don't have the SEC making the decision on what constitutes negligent failure to supervise or negligent failure to prevent these mistakes. You're subjecting that analysis to 50 juries across the country. And I'd actually, in that regard, like to respond to Judge Edwards' question about whether or not the SEC would be immune. And I think the key point there is the SEC is absolutely positively immune unless, of course, Congress has unequivocally waived its immunity. Well, here, of course, there's no argument that Congress has unequivocally waived the SRO's immunity. In fact, for the reasons I was just talking about, it's quite clear that Congress didn't want to waive the immunity of these people to damages suits. And if you analogize NASD and EDS to employees of the SEC, then in the 1988 FTCA amendments, they made it clear that the Westfall discretionary function exception didn't subject employees to liability. They said, no, you're immune regardless of whether or not it's a discretionary function. So whichever analogy they try and attach themselves to, it's clear that Congress has spoken and has said generally that, no, this is not the kind of activity we want to expose either the entities to or their employees to. My final point to answer your first question, Mr. Cox, would be I do think preemption analysis is actually the best way to analyze this, because obviously judicial immunity, the entire Westfall line of cases, is the judiciary on a common law basis narrowing the scope of a congressional statute. It's injecting itself between something that Congress should say is a damages. Here we have the antecedent question of whether or not Congress wants these lawsuits to go forward at all. So it's not the judiciary narrowing the scope of congressional inquiry. It's trying to determine whether or not Congress authorized that. And I would say you're mixing apples and oranges if you look to the immunity doctrines for federal employees to figure out the private right of action or preemption question. Again, my Bivens analogy. If you're trying to figure out whether federal employees are subject to Bivens lawsuits, you don't say, well, gee, Congress hasn't immunized federal employees against Bivens lawsuits, therefore we think it should go forward. You say to yourselves, just as the court did in the Plame case quite recently, has Congress set up a scheme that provides the safeguards that Congress thinks is the way of enforcing these rights? And if it has, then it has foreclosed either private rights of actions which go after their duties under the Exchange Act or common law torts which are just dressed up challenges to the SRO's exercise of its responsibilities under the Exchange Act. My time is up unless there's further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Martin, you used up all of your time. We'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. Let me just really quickly address this argument that there's explicit preclusion of our claims under this Exchange Act that Mr. Carvin just made. First of all, the Ninth Circuit in Lippitt and in the Northern District of California in the Mayo case have both agreed that, and this is from the Mayo case, Congress has not stated expressly that state laws affecting the regulation of SROs are preempted by the federal regulatory scheme established by the Exchange Act. And the court in Lippitt held that the Exchange Act preserves existing common law remedies, such as money damages, to protect persons from conduct that is actionable under common law. There's a saving clause in the Exchange Act, so I think it's just incorrect to say that there's explicit preclusion of our claim here. And one case that I would really like the court...
I think what counsel said was that there was implicit preclusion, wasn't there?
I heard him say that the...
Well, there was explicit provisions in the statute for the relief that your client was seeking, not the exact cause of action, but certainly the relief. You could have appealed, any of your clients could have appealed the denial of registration.
Well, I think that mischaracterizes the complaint in this action. I would urge the court to go back to the consolidated complaint, specifically paragraph 21. The complaint alleges that it was the erroneous testing result that caused the damage. In fact, what happened to my client, Jason Plunkett, is he took the test. He immediately learned that he failed the test, and he never was able to go back to work because of that. There wasn't a waiting to determine if his membership would be denied.
The paradox here is that if your clients had never been notified that they had failed the test, they wouldn't have a cause of action?
Well,
under your theory?
Under the theory that they didn't discover that the error had occurred until they were notified. That's correct.
They never would have. There's no way they would have been notified except by the NASD. So under your theory, the NASD is hoist on its own petard. They should have been quiet and let people be miserable.
Well, it could have chosen to do that. Again, we don't really know why it disclosed the information. This problem went on for 18 months.
Now, wait a minute. They disclosed it because they realized they made a mistake and it was unfair.
Well, we haven't had any discovery on why they did. You know, if there possibly there was a whistleblower that was about to take the information public. I don't know. I don't know why they disclosed the information. And then finally, I'm out of time, I believe, but I would just point the court to the decision in the Second Circuit, the Drake decision. It's a testing case. There was a very explicit standards and protocols set out by the FAA of how testing was to occur. And the Second Circuit determined that you could still bring, or the plaintiff in that case could still bring a common law claim even for negligence in the testing process, even though there was explicit regulations about how about safeguards and protocols that don't exist here. So I think it's an important case. Thank you for your time.